thank you, everybody, for joining us on this weekend's episode of Nevada Backcountry, brought to you by Hunt & House Archery Shop here in Reno. Man, we have got a really cool guest lined up today, Cody McKee with Nevada Department of Wildlife. Cody is a biologist that works for NDAO. Cody, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks, Henry. Really appreciate you guys inviting me to be here. I have enjoyed getting a chance to talk a little bit about the stuff that I get to do here the last few months especially, and always looking for opportunities to tell our story.
Yeah, and that's the big one. I'm sure you guys have been up to your eyeballs with the moose stuff. You are the moose guy in the state of Nevada, correct?
There's some truth to that, although we have several field biologists that are sprinkled throughout the state. They get to do the fun stuff and be out in the field doing the hands-on work. And I'm located in our Reno office. We have a handful of state coordinators that manage our big game species. And I'm fortunate to have both our Rocky Mountain elk as well as Shira's moose.
Yeah, because you started out as the official elk coordinator. As the moose started kind of appearing and becoming more prominent, you moved into the moose category as well.
That was always kind of part of my job description, although when I first started in this role, there really wasn't a whole lot of moose work involved. And so I think initially it kind of started out as a bit of a joke, but here more recently, our moose herd has just grown so quickly that it has really entailed a lot of additional workloads and just excitement to sort of follow the trajectory of our moose population here over the last 5 to 10 years.
When they first started showing up, it was more of just a anecdotal, like, oh my God,
I saw it on an elk hunt.
When I was elk hunting or antelope hunting. Here's a picture of something. What is it? And it wasn't as prominent as it seems to be now. I know myself, when Kerry Huebner was the biologist in that region, I used to go out just on my own time to see if I could see one, just to say, oh my God, I got to see a moose in the state of Nevada. Never did. Never came across
one. Oh, you never saw one?
No, because at first they're pretty elusive. I mean, it was like, you know, you were having one or two sightings, three sightings a year, it seemed like. Now it's a different story.
Before we go there, though, Cody, give us a brief introduction. Where you grew up? Did you grow up hunting? That sort of stuff?
Yeah. You know, like many people that are in this field and probably a lot of your listeners, I did grow up hunting. And I owe a lot of that credit to my dad. Grew up taking me out into the outback. So I grew up in Northeast Oregon, a little community called Imbler, which is in Union County. You know, hunting, that sort of rural culture is very prevalent in that area, and jumped into it really early. In fact, that part of the world, there's several biologists and folks that work with really prominent NGOs that grew up in that country. And so I think there is something to be said about how we grew up and the lifestyle that really facilitated our interest in this field. And frankly, I didn't actually know that you could become a biologist until I got into high school and started to consider what sort of career I wanted to pursue. Wildlife biology definitely wasn't my first choice, but once I got into college and started to experience, you know, what a future career might look like, I sort of just kind of reverted back into what I was most comfortable doing, which was being outside and understanding the landscape and how animals are using it, and then also just trying to preserve and conserve what we do have so that not just myself, but future generations can enjoy it like I've been able to.
We had Cody Schroeder on, and I forgot to ask him, but I'll ask you now, did being a hunter make you a better biologist, or has being a biologist made you a better hunter?
That's a really interesting question, and one that I had not fully pondered.
Okay.
And I think a little
I'll put you on the
there's
spot.
There's a little bit of both of those, right? Because, you know, a lot of people that work in our field do come from a hunting background. And so I think that there is something to be said about, does hunting facilitate your becoming a biologist? And I'm sure there's some relationship there. But I also think, you know, when I'm in the field and having that understanding of habitat preferences and time of year, time of day, and how critters are out on the landscape definitely feeds into my ability when I'm hunting as well. So I don't know if I can answer that definitively one way or another. I think there's sort of a give and take there.
Okay. Back in the day when you were a kid, what was your jam? Are you a mule deer guy, antelope? What'd you like to chase?
Gosh. Oh, man. We started out, I think I did a lot of chukar hunting and pheasant hunting with my dad. So I would say sort of getting into hunting started out pursuing game birds. And then as I kind of progressed and got a little bit older, my first hunt was a deer hunt. And then I remember fondly some of the elk hunts that I went out with my dad and my granddad when I was really young, out at elk camp, helping people pack out. There was a lot of exposure. And honestly, I don't know if I would have pinned myself as any of the above. And I still don't, because I enjoy all outdoor pursuits, whether it's bird hunting, whether it's big game hunting, or frankly, I just like to be outside. I do a lot of mountain biking and hiking and backpacking with my family, and try to do a little bit of fishing on the side when I can.
Talk me through the transition from, okay, you're in high school, maybe the inkling of I want to do something outdoors as a career. You said you started at Endow as a elk coordinator. Is that what you said, Dave?
Like staff specialist.
Staff specialist. Where'd you go to college and how'd you get into that?
I started my undergrad at the University of Idaho up in Moscow, and started in a different profession, to be honest. And I think it was after a semester of book studying about profession that might have been more lucrative, but frankly, I felt like I was going to be stuck inside all day. I kind of gravitated back towards something that would bring me outside, and I kind of leaned on that interest in hunting and being outdoors that really created this pathway for me to start looking at wildlife resources. University of Idaho at the time, and still does, had a great wildlife program, and that's why I went there. But in the process of getting accepted and starting my curriculum, I did a little bit of a detour and tried something for a little bit that frankly wasn't going to work for me and brought me back to where I'd started. And so, yeah, I went to the University of Idaho, finished my undergrad there. I did a little bit of seasonal work afterwards in Idaho for Idaho Fish and Game. But at that time, I had an interest in graduate school because I felt like there was a level of biostatistical background that I didn't really feel like I had fully fleshed out with a bachelor's degree and my ability to do a little bit more in-depth thinking and report writing that I could get through graduate school. So I was invited to come down to Reno and work on a mule deer project at the University of Nevada, Reno. And I finished up my master's degree there in 2012. So it took me a little bit of time to get down to Nevada. And that's kind of how I ended up down here in this part of the world.
Not only just finished your graduate work here at UNR, but you were also named the Graduate Student of the Year, correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, gotta toss that in there. Yeah. Endow doesn't recruit suckers.
Yep. So yeah, that's how I ended up here in Nevada. And frankly, I'd always been kind of drawn to the Desert Southwest. I grew up watching John Wayne movies with my grandpa. There was a part of me that always wanted to come down and experience the desert. And so when I had this offer to come down to Reno, it just felt right. And I've been in Nevada ever since.
So you keep mentioning the previous degree or previous fields you were in. Quit teasing us. What did you initially start college as? What was your major?
So I grew up in a really small town, and of course, everybody in a small town is a sports star. I had aspirations in athletics. I knew I was never going to be a professional athlete, but I thought maybe I could be a sports trainer. So I started in sports science, which would eventually lead me to either sports therapy or being an athletic trainer. But again, after a few months in that curriculum and program, it just didn't feel right for me. So again, just kind of reverted back to what I think I really was meant to do.
Okay, so fast forward, you're hired on at the Department of Wildlife here in Nevada. Did you just get thrown into elk?
I actually started with the Department of Wildlife down in Las Vegas. I worked on our wildlife water development program, and I did that for about 3 years. And to be honest, it was a great transition for me coming out of graduate school because I did spend a lot of time in the office and a lot of time in front of the computer analyzing data and writing. And so it felt good to be able to step away from that for a while and spend a little bit more time in the field and trying to get back in tune with the resources here in the Southwest. I ran that program for 3 years, and then there was an opportunity back in Reno to come up here and work within our game division. And at that time, it was a position that was more focused on data management and analysis. And then, frankly, kind of over time, my responsibilities changed. My position was accelerated and transformed into this elk coordinator. Elk's always kind of been my, has been near and dear to me and kind of my true passion. And so it was just a very seamless and sensible change in undertaking for me. And that occurred in about 2016, 2017.
The show is Nevada Backcountry. You're listening to 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. More after the break. And we are back on Nevada Backcountry, brought to you by Legacy Sports International. Special guest today is Cody McKee, the moose biologist for the state of Nevada. Before we went to break there, Cody, you were just starting to get into, you moved into an elk coordinator position. I think you said that was 2016, 2017. And you said there were moose sightings back then. I remember anecdotally hearing about them as early as like 2012-ish, guys hunting the Jarbidge area, and they would spot a moose on an elk hunt. Was there an established population by 2016, 2017?
I think we had a few here in the state. We probably had some breeding that was occurring. That was really early on in their establishment here, and frankly, we didn't put a lot of resources into understanding what the population was doing. We leaned heavily on those public observations, and we still do. If you look back at the history of moose sightings here in the state, we have them dating back to the 1950s, and then it was in the 90s we started seeing both bulls and calves, and I wouldn't say in groups, but generally in close enough proximity together that there's some suggestion that they were likely to breed during the breeding season. You know, at that time, you know, the sightings were sporadic enough that we didn't know fully if those movements were just moose that kind of moved down from Idaho or westward from Utah seasonally, or if they were actually here within the state year round.
So the big, and Lord knows, I love a good outdoors boogeyman like anybody else, but the big hullabaloo over the moose thing, everybody blames the wolves, the wolf expansion in Idaho, driving them into the state of Nevada. If we had established pairs as far back as the 90s, is there any truth to that now?
We don't have anything that suggests that wolves had any part in our moose population here in the state. In fact, if you look at the wolf pack distribution in Idaho, the last map that I saw, there weren't any established wolf populations south of Interstate 84. And so there's a large amount of country for those wolves to have one, have established without anybody knowing, and then also to have gone several hundred miles specifically just to influence the distribution of moose. So, you know, the short answer to that is it's all speculation, and we just don't have any information that indicates there's any truth to it. But what I can say is there's a lot of information about the ecology of moose that once you start to kind of put those pieces together, it really paints a good picture of, okay, we had moose, but now why do they seem to be doing so well?
What would you say was the number one factor as far as moose establishing a population in the state?
I mean, I think part of it is just how well they've been doing in southern Idaho, generally south of Pocatello and in Idaho Falls. They had this herd that is established and is probably starting to grow out of the current range that they're in. And so what happens when moose start to like hit up against whatever density-dependent or carrying capacity the landscape might have, that's when you start to see those younger animals disperse and move to other areas. I think as they just started moving south, they started finding these pockets of quality habitat here in Nevada. And those were the moose that we started seeing early on. You know, generally, new populations tend to have a higher ratio of males that are seen, and that's very much the case. When you look back at our historic observations, there were always tends to be a lot of young males that were being observed. And then over time, as they've established and matured, you start to see older males, and then females have moved into the area and established. And so it's a slow process. But what I do think happened probably 5 to 6 years ago, we reached some sort of minimum threshold of numbers where we were not just like seeing this gradual growth and expansion, but where it facilitated really rapid growth. And when you look at those public sightings and observations that we got, it really tells that story of, okay, there was a point up until 2013, 2014, where every year we were getting a handful of observations and nothing more. And then all of a sudden, those observations just grew rapidly and almost exponentially until this most recent year.
Dave, you said there's like a 1-to-1 bull to cow ratio right now or something like that?
I think it's actually higher than that. But Cody, what is the ratio right now, the bull to cow ratio?
It is right around 1-to-1. So what that means is in general, what we're observing on the landscape is for every female that we observe, adult female, we're also seeing one adult male. And because moose are polygynous species and you tend to have a single male or few males are able to successfully have these reproductive events with multiple females, those high sex ratios for males to females can often be detrimental to the population. And that's kind of bringing us to where we're at now with our hunting season, in that, one, we're seeing higher densities of moose than what we've experienced in years past, but also this really imbalanced sex ratio as well. And we have an opportunity to offer some limited harvest where we can also address this high bull to cow ratio that we've observed more recently.
When did Endow start really taking a look at the moose population?
In 2020 is when we really started that active monitoring program. And I think there was a little bit of window of time where we started noticing this uptick in observations, both from what the public was seeing, but also what our biologists were observing on flights. And we realized at that point in time that we probably need to start getting ahead of this population growth so that we can monitor what moose are doing and where they're going and where they came from. So in 2020, we established our first capture operation. We deployed 4 collars on adult females, cows, in northeast Nevada. Most of those were kind of like right on the Nevada-Idaho border. And then in subsequent years, we deployed additional collars. So after this most recent capture season here in winter 2024, we put out 9 cow collars and 6 bull collars here in the state. So we've captured and have been monitoring 15 adult moose over that time. And we're learning some really interesting things about their habitat preferences and how they're using the landscape. I mean, it checked off this big question mark for us right off the bat, is we aren't really experiencing movement between states. The movement that we are seeing, which is actually pretty limited, these moose have really small home ranges. It's all within the state boundaries. So that really supports this idea that we have a really healthy and sustainable population, and it's all occurring here within our boundaries.
The collars that were used, these are satellite collars, so that people out there kind of know that these are satellite collars. So these moose are being, monitored 24 hours a day. And then depending on how Cody downloads the information, you can get onto the system and download data. Are you doing it once a day or once a week?
We're getting several locations a day for moose, and we can go and look at those locations in real time. And so, yeah, the GPS data is super valuable. I mean, technology's come a long ways. These are collars that we can put out and leave on these animals for 4 or more years. They have built-in mechanisms that will allow those collars to drop off after a certain amount of time. So there's not the risk of them being collared and then those collars just staying on for the lifetime of the individual. More recently, in a partnership with Houston Safari Club and Texas A&M University, we were able to acquire video camera collars. And so we put out our first video camera collar on a cow moose.
Oh my God, how cool. Like a dash cam.
Exactly. And so when we recover that collar in 2 years, we're going to be able to download all of this really fine scale information, and we'll be able to view these snippets of video clips so we can look at what exactly are they feeding on? what's the status of their calf during that time of year? Who are they interacting with? Are there other adult cows? Is there higher levels of interaction with males during the breeding season? There's going to be all kinds of really interesting information that we're going to be collecting from those collars. I mean, frankly, I'm really excited about it. It's a really cool technology that's coming along, or that's come a long way the last few years. Unfortunately, I can't get the information from that collar until it drops off the cow, and that'll be a 2-year deployment. So we'll be getting those back in the spring of 2026.
How cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So, man, absolutely cool that Nevada is doing this stuff. We got to take a quick break. Don't go anywhere. Stay tuned to 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. If you're just joining us, the show is Nevada Backcountry, brought to you by Truck Envy here in Reno. And the guest today is Cody McKee. We're going over what everybody wants to talk about right now, which is moose in the state of Nevada. And Cody, you were just talking about a project, satellite collaring, no more old school radio telemetry stuff, a guy riding around on an ATV with a big antenna trying to locate an animal. You said that was a partnership with the Houston Safari Club International and Texas A&M?
Yeah, we have some collaborators down in Texas. They did a detailed habitat selection analysis for us. They also looked at some of the information that we have about predicted habitat use in Elko County and were able to provide us with a very rough estimate of a potential carrying capacity for moose within the area. And then through that collaboration, they went out and solicited funds from Houston Safari Club, and they came to us and refurbished some collars that Texas A&M had on hand. And these were these cool video camera collars. We're not only now getting this fine-scale movement information, but we're also going to be able to relate that to what was that moose doing at that particular time of day by reviewing these video snippets that are being collected at the time of that GPS point.
So that begs the question. I think Texas, I think whitetail farms, mule deer farms, pig hunting. Was this a specific moose collar they were developing and working on?
So Texas A&M in general has a really noteworthy and decorated ungulate research program in Kingsville.
Okay.
And then they more recently hired a graduate student that finished his dissertation at University of Nevada, Reno. And so we had this previous relationship of an individual that went there and then was interested in kind of helping us learn more about our moose population. So that was Dr. Marcus Bloom. He completed his project on bighorn sheep here in Nye County back in 2021, I believe. There was a bit of a previous relationship there, but Texas A&M has a history of bringing on some of the folks that are sort of at the lead of ungulate and big game research.
Gotcha. Yeah, I got to be honest, I got family in Texas, and if I was on a plane going to visit them and some dude told me he was studying moose at Texas A&M, I think he was pulling my leg, of all places to have a moose research. But with all that data that you guys are collecting, what do you kind of forecast as far as moose growth in the state of Nevada?
Just kind of based on our current projections and what our average calf-to-cow ratios are. So again, that's kind of that same relationship between bulls and cows. So when I talk about calf-to-cow relationship, we're mainly talking about how many calves does a single cow recruit into the adult population, and at that point, that is reproductively viable individual. If we're looking at an average calf-to-cow ratio over the last 5 years, our moose population is growing at about 20% annually, and that's pretty rapid growth. The work that Marcus did at Texas A&M, again, there's a lot of assumptions built into this, but we estimated that Elko County alone could support about 200 adult moose. We think that's probably a minimum number, and that population growth rate of about 20% will hit 200 here in about 4 years.
Okay. Hey, I want to switch gears on you. As you're talking about all this data and like the dash cam on cows and all this stuff, did you put in for the moose tag?
I did not. So, you guys probably know, there was an option to buy bonus points.
Yeah.
Okay.
And this year, I put in for a bonus point. I didn't put in for the draw. The reason being is that I know that there's already conspiracy theories about how the draw worked.
Yeah.
Completely unfounded, but
that's where I was going.
Felt like I don't want to put the department in a bad position, and I don't want to have to deal with the fallout if, for some happenstance, I got a good number in the draw and got one of those tags.
Yeah, I was going to say, so here's my full disclosure to everybody listening. I don't know you. You seem like a nice enough guy in this interview, but I would have a bone to pick if the guy that's watching the dash cam video and has all the telemetry data draws the tag, and here I am, John Q. Public, like having to put in the sweat equity to find a moose. And then you're out there with your little data card looking at stuff. I'd go, man, you got to be kidding me.
That's where people go. There was a comment on our Instagram.
Yeah.
One gentleman said, well, I wonder what two Endow employees, probably game wardens, who got the tags.
Yeah.
And so there's always going to be that, even though there's nothing showing that there's preference to any one person or group whatsoever. But
hypothetical here, let's say one of these two tag holders, which at this point I know who they are. We've talked about it on the show. But let's say one of the two tag holders gets somehow tracks you down. Are you pretty forthcoming with, hey, you know, these are areas I would go look at based on the data? Or is that something Endow plays close to the vest?
First of all, we have some really like rigorous internal standards and procedures for handling these types of scenarios. We're forbidden from sharing that movement data for anything that's over or anything under a year old. So you could never get access to data that's less than a year, that's recent. And then on top of that, there's some pretty serious ethical and moral issues at play when it comes to, you know, having access to this information and how it's being fed to the public, or frankly, for people to have tags. And so that could lead to some pretty serious ramifications within the department if somebody were to misuse their data. With respect to like how we're interacting with the individuals that are hunting, by no means will we be providing specific location data about moose here in the state. What we can provide is general locations or places to go. I mean, when you look at our distribution maps of where our observations are occurring, and anybody from the public can go and download that information from my commission presentations that I've given or from our status book, you'll see where the core of the moose population is occurring in places that you can go to. So potentially general areas just based on our understanding of moose distribution, which is no different than what we would give to a hunter that had a deer and elk tag, but we would absolutely not use this high-level data to help a hunter in the field. Definitely goes against a lot of our own policies, as well as just raises some pretty serious ethical concerns.
Let's say next year you plan on putting in for the moose tag, or are you just going to do bonus points again?
I'll start putting in next year, and if I do, I would cut off my access to this information. We have standards for our biologists that they're unable to fly surveys within areas where they draw tags. We're all hunters at heart, and so we put in safeguards to prevent the misuse of proprietary data that we're collecting to help aid somebody while they're hunting. I mean, sure, we're biologists, and maybe we have a better sense of how animals are using the landscape, but we're not misusing data that's being collected directly off of an animal to inform our hunter to get access to higher quality individuals.
That's exactly where I was going with that, because I've never asked those questions of an Endow employee or an Endow biologist, but with something like moose, with as much scrutiny as going to be on this hunt, I figured it was a good time to put one of you on the spot and see what the protocol and procedure there is.
So the two individuals that were the lucky ones to receive these tags, are they going to be in close contact with you, or you're going to be with them during this entire season?
We've already been in contact, but the reason for that contact is more to discuss data collection procedures. So we're asking our hunters to help us out with things like conducting tick surveys on their carcass, because winter ticks start falling off of a carcass within 6 hours, and there's just no way that a moose hunter is going to be able to get their carcass off the mountain whole to an Endow office for us to conduct those surveys. So a lot of the contact that we're having with them currently is to set up training sessions on how they could do things like a tick survey or remove a tooth for aging. What are some good protocols that they might try and use to preserve meat while they're up there? Because these are really big animals. And for folks that are used to maybe getting their animal off the mountain whole, that's probably unlikely in the case of a 1,000-pound to 1,200-pound bull moose. So it's mostly, okay, once you get your animal, what's next?
Hey, so when we come back, I want to dive into some of the logistics of the hunt and execution of the hunts. Before we do that, we got to take a break. Don't go anywhere. The show is Nevada Backcountry on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. Final segment of the show here on Nevada Backcountry. Special guest today is Cody McKee, and we just started getting into some of the stuff Endow is asking of these hunters. One of the things you brought up, Cody, intrigued me. Hey, look, it's a moose tag in the state of Nevada. If it's a legal bull, I'd be killing it. But that being said, give me a rough estimate of like a quality Nevada bull score-wise.
That's a good question. I don't have experience judging a Shire's moose on the hoof. When I look through some of the minimum record book requirements, I think the score is 150 to 155. And I do think that we have moose here that will meet that or exceed that score. But again, there's a lot of this information that we're kind of counting on our hunters to sort of help feeding us at the get-go in kind of consideration of what the moose herd has been doing and where we saw that rapid growth here more recently, as well as discussions from other states. It seems like we'll probably see the best scoring bulls will be in the 4 to 5 age range. And then what that means from an actual Boone and Crockett score, I can only speculate. I do think that we have some really nice bulls here. And whether or not the hunters are going to be able to find them, I think that's going to depend on how much effort they put in.
One real quick question, Cody. This has been asked by a bunch of our listeners. Is the picture on the book?
Oh, yeah.
They're asking, is that one of the bulls in the state of Nevada? There have been a ton of different scenarios. People are like, oh, no, that's a Wyoming Shiras. Oh, no, that's an Idaho. Oh, that was a picture from National Geographic.
So I can quote the Department of Wildlife. That is a stock image. My understanding is that it's potentially from Wyoming area. Unfortunately, we have a lot of moose pictures here, but we don't have the quality of moose photos that you would want to have for publication materials.
Got it.
Okay.
That clears it. So the one person that said, I think that's a Wyoming Shiras.
Could have been right.
He's the winner.
Okay. Oh, man.
And that did get a lot of, we got a lot of scrutiny. The department did provide a statement on Facebook relative to where this photograph came from. I don't know if specifics of where it exactly came from, but I probably saw some of the same comments as you guys that this may have been a bull moose that was frequently photographed near around Yellowstone National Park. It is a Shiras bull moose, and I can say that I've seen pictures of bulls from Nevada that are very much in line with the same bull. But again, it comes down to publication quality and whether or not we have those kind of photos, and we just didn't have any available to us.
I want to say on the picture thing, Cody, you've been nothing but a disappointment to me with that. I went to bat for Endow on that and like, get out of here, man. Of course it's a picture of a moose from Nevada. So to everybody that I poo-pooed when they told me that, I'm offering my sincere apologies. I was wrong. On to the hunt. Yeah, I want to get into, like I said, it's the final segment of the show here. Talk to the listenership out there as far as what's expected, how rural and remote these populations of moose are, the amount of work involved.
You know, first of all, I've got to say this isn't going to be a canned hunt by any means. Our hunters that drew the tag this year are definitely going to have to work to be successful. And that's just because we have what I think is a really strong moose population. Just we don't have a ton of moose here in the state. Our most recent estimates, just over 100 adults. The projected harvest represents about 2% of the overall population. So it's a very light harvest, very light endeavor as we kind of work our way into it. And so with that said, there is going to be a level of getting out into the field, and whether it's scouting or leaning on your fellow hunters. So I've kind of looked at it. We're offering this really long season, and part of it is just it's the first time we're doing it. There's not a lot of moose hunters in the field. I don't think you're going to be in competition with anybody, but we wanted to provide a different experience depending on how you wanted to go about your hunt. So one, you have this long season starting September 1st to the end of November. It covers both right when antlers, right when they shed velvet and go to hard antlers. Bulls will still be kind of hanging out in their traditional home range that they would have outside of the breeding season. And then the season carries all the way through the rut, and then post-rut behavior and potentially even when snow comes and how that may affect the movements of our moose where you might be able to find them. So because of that long season, it provides just a really variable opportunity for how you want to hunt. You know, one, you can get out and scout early and find bulls, and there's a better chance that those bulls will be there right when the season starts. You can go out during the rut when bulls are moving around a lot, and that's when we get a lot of our observations. So that's roughly early October. Another strategy is to go out when rifle deer season starts, and we have the most rifle deer hunters in the field. Talk to your fellow hunter and ask them what they've been seeing. I think that could be a really effective and productive strategy to figure out what bulls are out there and where they might be. You guys know here in Nevada, September 1st, I mean, it could be 85, 90 degrees.
Oh, yeah.
Even
oh, yeah.
In our high elevation mountain ranges. And so, and again, that kind of goes back to why we want to have early and often communication with our hunters, just to reinforce the importance of thinking about what happens after you get your moose. Because I think everybody's excited about the opportunity, the first hunt, where are they going to hunt, what are they looking for, but the work is really going to start when they've successfully punched their tag.
And most definitely.
How are they going to get everything off the mountain and preserve meat, just to ensure that it's an enjoyable experience from start to finish.
I will give you the last word. What do you want to leave listeners with when it comes to moose in the state of Nevada?
First and foremost, it's just such a cool story. I don't think in my lifetime I'll ever get a chance to experience the establishment and proliferation of such a majestic creature, wildlife species like moose. And I think very few people in our field get to do that. And then also, just to reinforce the importance of hunting in our understanding of moose, it's very much a conservation tool. We're going to be gaining a tremendous amount of information about our moose through the harvest of just two bulls. And I think that has been overlooked or maybe downplayed in this conversation.
Cody, sincere thank you for taking the time to hop on Nevada Backcountry. Open door, you ever want to come back on, especially after this hunt season, let us know how it went.
Yeah, talk elk.
Talk elk. Yeah, we'd love to have you back on the show, man.
Yeah, for sure. I love talking about these species and kind of getting the word out there about what we do.
Sincere thanks, Cody.
Thank you, Cody.
Thanks, guys.
Okay, man, what a cool interview that was. Before we get out of here, I want to bring up, man, our most communicative, if that's a word.
I'm going to say it's a word.
Our most communicative Instagram follower. I love this guy, JJ Basin Chaser. Did you see the message he sent us?
No, I did not.
Okay, so I got a correction to issue. And JJ, I can't remember your actual name. I'm not sure if it's on your account. But man, sincere thank you for listening to the show and providing valuable feedback. We brought up the example of my dad turning in that sheep tag.
Yeah.
And we talked about how that would go to an alternate. Apparently, he's saying there's a 10-day window, like 10 days out from the start of the hunt.
Correct.
That actually pops into a first come, first serve tag. It does not go to the alternates.
Correct.
Oh, yeah. That is correct.
But he is correct.
Okay.
I thought we covered that.
No,
we did
I
not.
Think I don't. We might have screwed it up.
Did you cut that out?
I might have.
Yeah. Yeah. Because 10 days within the hunt.
I just wanted to make you look bad, Dave.
Yeah, no, thanks, man. Thanks. I really appreciate that. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that's it. I'm going to take my participation trophy and I'm leaving.
So, no. Go through it real quick.
No, he's 100% right. If it's within 10 days of the start of the hunt, it goes straight to first come, first serve. It doesn't go. If there's any alternates within 10 days of the hunt, the alternate list disappears. It goes straight to first come, first serve.
Okay. All right. So
he is 100% right. And thank you for catching that.
He brought it up, man. He sent us a message. And unfortunately, he said something. I guess we left his last message on red. He had some points about that mountain goat hunt and he wanted an archery thing. We kind of covered that, but without going way off the rails here, JJ, sincere thank you for pointing this stuff out. And I will take that one on the chin. Apparently I did some editing and I made Dave be wrong.
Which is not hard to do. Well, I'm just saying.
Friends like these, man.
Yeah, you know, you just got to take what you can get.
Yeah, so sincere thank you to everybody for tuning in. Thanks to Cody McKee for joining us. Full disclosure, next week is probably going to be a rerun because I'm going to be sitting on a boat in the Keys.
Lucky.
Yeah, so not sure what I'll plug in there, but thank you to the show sponsors. Thank you to our listeners. Everybody get out, enjoy the outdoors this Sunday.
Enjoy.